Attention, students of Vince Lombardi High School. I am Miss Togar, your new principal, and I'm here to go over some of the new school protocol. All ladies must wear skirts below the knees. All young men must...
Beat it, Pinhead!
Who let you hoodlums in here? And who the hell do you think you are?
Dee Dee, Marky, Johnny and Joey. It's time to beat on this brat with a baseball bat.
What? What? Oh no!
Rock and Roll High School is now in session. Class dismissed.
Listening to See Here Podcast, episode 41. Podcast is in session. Principal Morris over here, and with me, my learned colleagues, senior lecturer Bernard Stickwell. Good evening.
Good evening, class.
And blackboard monitor, Mr. Tim Merrill.
There'll be no tardiness in my class.
You're listening to See Here Podcast, episode 41, in case I hadn't mentioned it. And even if I had mentioned it, you're still listening to episode 41 of the See Here Podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. We are the podcast where we talk about music-related films. So if this is your first time joining us, thank you very much. I think this is a really great episode for you to be joining us for the first time, because we're going to have a lot of fun with this one. And if you've been with us for all previous 40 episodes, well, then you get to go home early. Thank you very much. The film we're going to be discussing, as Tim has already indicated, is Rock and Roll High School. So we're going to play the trailer, have a little bit of fun, go out, get a drink, smoke in the boys' room or in the girls' room if you're so inclined, and we'll be back to discuss a little bit of Ramones and Riff Randall. You're listening to See Here.
It's 1980. Welcome to Rock and Roll High School.
Rock and Roll High School?
Do you want to stay there?
I am Miss Togar, and I am the new principal of this school. And who are you?
I'm Riff Randall, rock and roller.
The only girl I ever dream about at night is Riff.
I've done more detentions than anyone in the school's history.
Are you a virgin? How about a cheerleader? Nice set of pom-poms.
Term wanted Riff. But Riff wanted to live a rock and roll fantasy to the music of her favorite group.
The hottest band this side of the Iron Curtain, the Ramones!
You have managed to upset the entire school with its godforsaken noise.
Things sure have changed since we got kicked out of high school.
Hey, come on, you guys!
They tried to stop their music, but the kids got wrecked and rocked the school.
I just talked to the chief of police. He's going to storm the building.
school, the school where the students rule. Could your school be next?
Hi, this is Jeremy from the Podcast We Listen To podcast. I wanted to take a second to talk to you about a thing that we're putting together called PodCon 2018. This is a convention of podcast listeners for podcast listeners and by podcast listeners. And yeah, hosts are listeners too. I listen all day long. This is going to be the fall of 2018 in New Orleans, and it's going to be a blast. It's being put together by myself, members of the Podcast We Listen To Facebook group, and hosts of several of your favorite shows, including Dina from Twisted Philly and Allie from Insight. Fall of 2018 gives us time to put it together right. We're really looking forward to it. There is so much excitement. The Podcast We Listen To Facebook group is blowing up over it. For more information, you can join the Podcast We Listen To Facebook group, or you can follow at PodCon2018 on Twitter. And as soon as we finalize more details, we will put those out there for you. In the meantime, just keep listening to your favorite shows, and you'll probably hear something about it.
Okay, file in orderly. Yep, everyone at your seats. You're back with See Here Podcast, episode 41. Today's film is Rock and Roll High School, directed by Alan Arkush, produced more famously, though, by one Mr. Roger Corman. The film came out in 1979. The writers for the film, Richard Whitley and Russ, I'm not sure if I've got this right, Devonch, I think that's it, how you pronounce, and Joseph McBride, starring PJ Souls as
Riff Randall, rock and roller,
Vincent Van Patten, who will probably talk a little bit about another school film that he made a few years later, but not quite as the same dorky character that he plays here, Clint Howard, the better looking brother of two very famous showbiz brothers, Day Young, the wonderful Mary Woronov, and Paul Bartel, and I'm missing someone. Oh yeah, the Ramones.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There's a cast.
That's quite
there's a cast of characters as well. Yeah, there's a whole mess of people in there.
Obviously, you do not know who I am. I am Miss Togar, and I am the new principal of this school.
Let's give the basic plot, as if you haven't seen it, and as if you need it, but I'll read it anyway. This is from IMDb. A group of rock music-loving students, with the help of the Ramones, take over this school to combat its newly installed oppressive administration. Not quite right, but who cares? All right, Tim, this was your choice. It seems like a superfluous question, but what made you pick it?
Well, funny thing was that, you know, my introduction to the Ramones, believe it or not, was before video was actually classified as video. I remember seeing on Don Kirshner's rock concert, they'd play these extended, you know, music movies, like, you know, which were technically videos, you know, before they were like Alice Cooper's Elected. There was a bunch of them that were done in the 70s, you know, they were just the precursor to the whole video era. And the one that got me was Rock and Roll High School. That was the first time I'd ever heard the Ramones, and I had no idea. And you might laugh at this because of the stupidity of youth, but I thought these guys were all Mexican. Because I thought
Ramon was their first name.
Yeah, I thought Johnny Ramon, and then Didi Ramon, and then I thought they were all Mexican dudes, right? But then friends of mine actually went to the drive-in and saw this. And I didn't get to see it, but they saw it when it dropped. And it was a film that, you know, for a long time, it was kind of, you know, relegated to obscurity until the video era came and, you know, they put it out. And then you used to be able to see this every either Friday or Saturday night on late night cable television. It was a big staple of like Toronto TV. Toronto used to have this thing called late great movies, where they put on a movie at 2 a.m. just when everybody's coming home from partying. So it was like that movie that could, you know, you still couldn't sleep, but you still wanted to keep the neighbors up. So there was something to watch. It's a film that it's a hell of a lot of fun. And even if you really don't know anything about the Ramones and you do think they're Mexican, there's still something that you can get out of this. You know, it's an absolute blast. And I think that, you know, for everything that Roger Corman's name has been tied to, this is a film that should be recognized, you know, up there with Piranha and everything else that Corman touched, with the involvement of Alan Arkush, you know, the director, and Joe Donne. What I think they tried to do with this was it's almost like a punk rock Grease.
Tell me about it. Stir.
Morris, I think you and I were talking earlier in the week about those 50s juvenile delinquent films, the ones they tried to tie music to, you know, like Blackboard Jungle and Rock Around the Clock. And there was a lot of these films from the 50s, I think, that this film is an actually a tribute to. the whole thing is, too, is that they wanted to have, like, with Grease, that soundtrack that is basically the centerpiece of the whole film, you know, and that's the same thing with this, is that they wanted a score that they could hawk with the film. So I don't think it was much that the film was soundtrack was the market for the film. I think the film was market for the soundtrack.
Right. So you've already gone and said it's sort of like a punk rock Grease, and it certainly had the humor and the zaniness that Grease, which was the earlier film and certainly earlier musical, had. But I'd say that Rock and Roll High School is a subversive film using humor for it. And, you know, if you don't think that humor can be subversive, then look at the Marx Brothers.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it.
Do you guys sort of see this as a subversive film?
Don't know. I mean, it's subversive in the fact that it's fulfilling all those dreams that teenagers would probably have about their school, you know, not putting up with the authority and, spoiler alert here, basically taking over the school and blowing it up at the end.
It's in the trailer, so, you know, no
it's,
spoiler.
It is rebelling against authority and, you know, thus society. So I guess in that respect, you could say it's subversive. I don't know. What do you think, Tim?
It's kind of funny because it takes me back to memories of my own public school. Whenever the summer vacation would begin, our teacher would actually let one guy bought the 45 of Alice Cooper Schools Out.
When we got
and the teacher would actually let us play it on those big block record players. And right before we left for summer, we went off for the summer. You know, the last thing we got to do at the end of the day was to play Alice Cooper Schools Out, you know, and we all felt like we were just being so deviant, you know. It's just, oh yeah, man, like, you know, to hell with school. We're going off on vacation forever, you know. And the film does kind of revel in that. There's a bit in the film where they're in the locker room and Riff Randall's talking to the girls about skipping school to go see the Ramones.
Boy, I wish we could see them this Thursday at their concert.
So what's stopping you?
We can't cut classes to stand in line for tickets.
That's right.
Oh, please. 10 years from now, no one will care if you've ever been to high school, much less skipped a few classes.
You all act as if everything's so important around here.
I mean, just because Togar is stuck in the 50s doesn't mean there isn't life after high school, you know. I mean, I've got my own future to think about. I know I can write for the Ramones. All I've got to do is get my songs to them.
And then the girls are like, what if we get punished? Or, what? You know, like, we're going to get nailed for it. And she goes, you know, you're going to remember this for the rest of your life. You know, like, this is your life. We're young. You know, we got to be free. We, you know, like, this is what we're meant to do. This is our destiny. So I think, you know, there is a lot of subversion in this film, too.
It's quite cartoonish. It's not sort of mean-spirited, is it?
No.
Miss Togar is very much a kind of sort of stereotypical kind of monster-type creature in a way.
Right.
You know, and the lines are drawn between good and bad. Like I say, there's no real mean-spirited.
What you're saying about there's no mean-spiritedness about it and everything, really, when you think about it, to me, this film totally comes across almost like a Mad Magazine cartoon.
Absolutely. You couldn't have summed it up better. Yeah, absolutely.
It's like a Mad Magazine cartoon. I mean, with Mort Drucker or like one of... the whole thing is just, well, you know, going from this little snippet of humor to that little snippet of humor to that little snippet of humor, just the way that Mad would have those little caption bubbles,
it's packed full, isn't it? There's lots of little gags going on in the background,
right.
And there's that recurring character who keeps getting beaten up before sort of locked in the trophy cabinet or whatever.
No, not the locker. Anything but the locker.
I laughed how everybody supposed to be in high school is like, you know, 30 years old.
Yeah, that's always the case with the high school films in the States, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. Bernie, you went and said something about Miss Togar, and she comes across as, you know, the very stereotypical American school film type of principal. And yet there's one difference that I sort of thought about, especially in the light of a very recent Projection Booth episode where they were talking about Mummy Dearest. And that was, I would have thought that her character would have been far more prone to wild outbursts. And she was always very low rumbling, all very menacing. Mary Woronoff is not an explosive type of actress. She's very much, you will bring Riff Randall to me. I think other films might have had her in a more Joan
Crawford. Sort of over the top.
Joan Crawford over the top.
No wire hangers ever!
There will be no wire hangers here at this school!
No. You know, she embodies the establishment, doesn't she? She's grey and all the rules are set in concrete. You can't mess around with this stuff. But at the same time, it's all very kind of level-headed and, you know, like you're saying, Morris, not over the top or angsty, which, you know, it's kind of more menacing and more realistic in a way, isn't it? I guess as realistic as you get.
Not to sound like a pig here or anything, but she kind of reminds me of the warden in those Wicked Warden films.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get
you know
that.
I mean, like she's and those two little toadies, the two little hall monitors she has are like her little subs, you know, and she's like the dom, you know, and you can just see her with a feathered riding crop, you know, and just like, you know, you two out of my office now.
Well, one of them keeps writing that kind of fan fiction.
My darling Evelyn, how I long for the feel of your luscious thighs wrapped around.
He looks like Buzz Osborne out of the Melvins.
I just had this thought crop into my head. This is a Roger Corman school film equivalent of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Please do, Billy. Explain everything.
Mary Woronoff is completely Nurse Ratched.
Yeah.
And those two little toadies are like Washington and I forgot the name of the other nurse, but and Riff Randall is completely Randall Patrick McMurphy.
Yeah,
totally, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, you know, people say that your music is loud and destructive and lethal to mice, but I think you're the Beethovens of our time.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the pre-production history of the film. I caught some of the commentary on the film and read a couple of really interesting interviews with Alan Arkush. I think it's pretty much common knowledge that Corman originally wanted to make a film to cash in on the success of Saturday Night Fever. And
he wanted to call it Disco High, didn't he?
Correct. What I didn't know was that it started actually even earlier than that, and he asked Arkush to create a film called Girls' Gym. And you can only imagine that it would have been a very, very different type of film. Corman said to Arkush to include new gymnastics. Now, I don't know if we'd still be talking about this film today. It would not have been PG film.
Again, to sound like a pig, I mean, but when you see those girls in the gym in there, you know, there's not a lot left up to the imagination, too.
As we were saying earlier, the fact that this film isn't mean-spirited, it's quite wholesome in a way as well, because it kind of goes to a certain point, but it doesn't go beyond that. So there's a lot of opportunities where you could imagine naked bodies, and they kind of don't do it at all, I don't think. I don't think there's any nudity. No,
the fantasy sequence, which we're going to talk about, I'm sure, a little bit further down the track.
Oh, sure. Okay, yeah.
But even that's very, very mild. The other interesting thing about that, one of the famous stories is that they approached Cheap Trick to be the band that was going to be the center of the film, but they wanted too much money. But what I didn't know was that another really favorite band of mine, The Tubes, had been approached to make this film. I think really that going with the Ramones, I mean, everything is obvious in hindsight, but as much as I love The Tubes, and they're a very, very theatrical band, but they would have made the film a lot more about The Tubes. And really, when it comes down to it, this is Riff Randall's story. It's not the Ramones' story. I mean, they're a very strong part of it, and they're the reason for her obsession. Right. But and whenever they're on screen, they own it. But it is Riff Randall's story.
And if you don't like it, you can put it where the monkey puts the nuts.
Speaking of the soundtrack and music in this, there's one thing that always got me. At the beginning of the film, when you're actually getting to see Kate Rambeau, when she basically meets Van Patten's character, there's a song that's playing, and I swore the first time I heard it that it was Paul McCartney.
Did we meet somewhere before? Far behind that half-closed door. to both of us.
It is.
It is, isn't it?
That's, yes. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's that, it was a song that was originally offered for Warren Beatty's film Heaven Can Wait, and it's never been on an official Paul McCartney or Wings album. He'd been wanting to put together an album of odds and sods called Cold Cuts, and if you look in the bootleg circles, you can get it that way, but it has never officially been released. I don't even think it's on the Rock and Roll High School soundtrack album.
I always thought, well, how the hell did they manage to get McCartney on there? Because, you know, for the budget of the film, I mean, like, that would have been the percentage of the whole budget,
sure,
just
yeah,
getting the
yeah.
one track. And I always thought that might have been somebody else, but it didn't, you know, that seems like, sounds like McCartney to me.
Well, I think, I was sort of wanted to talk a little bit about the music as well. When you think about, look, who else is on the soundtrack? You know, you've got Fleetwood Mac's Albatross at one point, and you've got Chuck right. Berry's School yeah. Days, and as well as, you
yep,
know, all the
Brownsville Station.
Yeah,
Smoking in the Boys' Room. And really, I mean, in 2017, you would never get all of those songs. You might get, you know, one, if anything. And a Corman film, if for nothing else, it's known for its budget. And
right.
really, here we are looking at this and thinking, how the hell did he get all these songs?
That's what's insane when you consider it.
Different times, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Now, the song, the McCartney and Wings song, was called Did We Meet Somewhere Before? And yeah, he'd offered it to Warren Beatty for Heaven Can Wait. And crazy, they knocked him back. I mean, regardless of whether you like the song or you don't like the song, but Warren Beatty was knocking back Paul McCartney and Wings, which was, you know, one of the biggest bands on the planet, and certainly, you know, McCartney, an ex-Beatle. Who the hell was Warren Beatty thinking that he was? So Corman stuck up his hand and said, look, I'll take it if you want to give it to us. So so that's amazing.
And it ends up in Rock and Roll High School. That's kind of far out. That's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
And that's another interesting thing about the use of music in the film. Okay, obviously this is a story about the Ramones, and the Ramones are like the new guard of rock and roll. And, you know, there's all these stories about how in the 70s, through art rock and prog rock, punk was a reaction to rock and roll becoming bloated, and stadium bands and artists being paid millions and millions of dollars.
Right, they pissed on all the keyboards and capes.
Correct. Yeah. But it's interesting to see that really, in the end, the film is a celebration of music. And they weren't using Wings as a means of saying, oh, listen to this old shit, the Ramones is so much better. It's just a song that's on the soundtrack, an Albatross by Fleetwood Mac. Okay, granted, right. It was the blues Fleetwood Mac. It wasn't the Stevie Nicks Fleetwood, right. Christy McVie Fleetwood Mac. It was still that name. It was all these classic rock songs, all these classic rock bands, and they fitted in to the story,
well,
as it were.
It's Rock and Roll High School. It's not Punk High School, is it? And the fact that Riff Randall is Riff Randall Rock and Roller, not Riff Randall Punk. I don't think the Ramones are referred to as punk at all. I don't even know if the word punk comes up in the film.
Well, listen to the songs in the film. I mean, there's a lot of people who've gone and said, well, the Ramones were never really a punk band. And we'll leave that debate for some other forum. But certainly the songs that they're playing, Sheena is a punk rocker. It's a Beach Boys song.
Well, the kids are all up to be ready to go. They're ready to go now. They got a fence up on them. They're going to the discotheque to go to. But she just couldn't stand. She had to break away. Well, New York City really had it all. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She is a punk rocker. She is a punk rocker. She is a punk rocker now.
I Want You Around is a great Birds like ballad, if you will.
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of? It totally reminds me of, like, Needles and Pins.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which,
yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Which they cut. Yeah. These songs are just great celebration of the history of rock and roll music and pop music. And the us and them is us, the students, versus them, the teachers, the establishment, rather than
one side of music
versus another side of music. And I think that's a wonderful, refreshing thing.
Well, I think one thing that's kind of nice that you're pointing out was about soundtracks is that back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of films, there was such a diversity of artists in soundtracks, you know, because the soundtracks back then, because of the success of Saturday Night Fever, like you said, in Grease, and Rocky Horror Picture Show, a lot of things, they wanted to cover all the bases. So I think, you know, they wanted to have something for everyone in these soundtracks. If you didn't like the Ramones, there was Cheap Trick. If you didn't like Cheap Trick, then there was Fleetwood Mac. If you didn't like Fleetwood Mac, then there was Brownsville. I mean, like, or Chuck Berry. They wanted to basically cover all their bases, and I think that's what they try to do.
Well, particularly this coming from Corman, the king of exploitation, is about almost lowest common denominator and, you know, appealing to more people to make as much as you can with as little money thrown in at the front end.
Right,
so
right.
Not to say that, you know, this is a lowest common denominator movie, but the more people you appeal to, the better, you know?
Well, you heard it, folks. Miss Toger has just given the students of Rock and Roll High an ultimatum, a classic confrontation between mindless authority and the rebellious nature of youth. The moment of truth is at hand. What will these kids do next?
I want to come back to a topic that we started on like a few minutes ago, and sort of about teenage rebellion in films. And I was sort of thinking about that, really, as far as schools go, there's maybe only been two or three stories told. Obviously, you know, the detail being a variation, but I think there's two or three stories that are told in school.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
You've got the films where the teacher is the inspiration. So films like Stand and Deliver, or maybe not so much an inspiration, although maybe used by the end, Blackboard Jungle.
To Sir With Love.
To Sir With Love. Yeah, absolutely. If you want to go down the television route, then there's, you know, Welcome Back, Cotter. You know, the teacher is the inspirational guy, the hero. Or you can also get the films where the teacher is still the good guy, but the students rebel against him, like, as if in a threatening sort of way. So there's
right.
Class of 1984, which I mentioned before, and
right.
Starting once again Dick Van Patten, who's a threat rather than the dorky jock.
Vincent Van Patten, you mean?
Oh, sorry. So did I? Oh, sorry. Vincent Van Patten. My mistake. And also,
Dick Van Patten was his dad.
His dad. Yeah. That's right. Well, I don't know whether you guys are fans of The Wire, but season 4 of The Wire was all set in.
Of course, yeah.
In a school, and once again, you know, the uphill battle that Przybylowski faces against his students. But then there's also the films where the students are encouraged basically to stick it to the man, as it were, and, you know, School of Rock
right.
is
Dead
great
Poet
example.
Society.
Dead Poet Society. But Rock and Roll High School certainly fits in the category where the students are encouraged, at least filmically, to stick it to the man. There's no
right.
doubt that. I keep wanting to say Nurse Toga because I'm thinking of Nurse Ratched. But Principal
now,
Toga is.
This isn't a school film, but one film that I could compare this to, and you might have seen this, Bernie. You know,
I bet I had the exact same one in my mind. Go on, yeah. Go
Over
on.
The Edge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know this film, Morris?
No, I don't.
Over the Edge, it was a film, I think it came out around the same time, and it was about a group of kids that were living in a suburban development community. I think it was out in California, was it, Bernie?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like where they started suburbia, and so
yeah.
These kids are out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing for them to do. Nobody's supporting these kids. All the kids want to do is basically ride dirt bikes, get high, and listen to music, right? And then things happen, and then the local community school says, you know, like, these kids are getting unruly. There's something we got to do about the kids. And then the community center, they want to shut it down, and they provide these kids with an alternate to kind of go and do their thing, but it's really nothing at all. And it's more of a dramatic film, but it's great.
It's quite dark, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But I think it would be, it's a really good comparative piece, though, to Rock and Roll High School.
Directed by Tim Hunter, who went on to make River's Edge.
River's Edge, yeah.
Which is one of my favorites.
From your description of that film, it certainly sounds like it fits into the Stand and Deliver model of the film, where the kids can potentially do great. They're on the wrong side of the tracks. No one believes in them but one guy.
There's not even really one guy in this film. It's just kind of, you know, a bunch of kids that are basically supporting themselves. There's nobody that's really believing in them or nobody giving them. It's like that us versus them. Like you're saying, the establishment versus youth.
It's all about that disconnect between one generation and another, and they don't know how to deal with the kids anymore because, you know, the whole suburban thing and and so forth. So it's almost like they're just given up on, and they're, you know, they're not fitting into the molds that they're trying to be forced into. So what else do you do?
Well, it sounds a little bit like that film that you brought to the show maybe like over a year ago, Bernie Suburbia.
Yeah,
there you go. It's, again, you can make those comparisons, definitely, yeah.
Sure.
Maybe not quite as bleak as that, but certainly along those lines, yeah.
This is the big time, girly. This is rock and roll.
Can we talk about a couple of certainly our great favorite scenes in this film? Ultimately, this, whilst there is a narrative that goes over the course of the film, but there are certainly some set pieces that really make this film great, certainly in my mind. And actually, I got to say that even though this is Riff Randall's film and there's a lot of wonderful things going on there involving her in the story, but for me, the two greatest sequences in the film both involve the Ramones. I've already sort of gone to mention one of them, and that's the fantasy sequence with the band serenading Riff in her bedroom. I want you, the song I Want You Around. It's funny and it's sweet all at once. For all of Riff's idolizing of the band, it's as a symbol of her love of rock and roll, and it's really an inspiration for her to write her own music. She idolizes the band, but really what makes this film different, she's not a groupie like this other character, Angel Dust, that comes into the film. She loves the Ramones and says, I want to be your peer. And later on in the film, they crown her. They give her a leather jacket. She becomes their peer. They're proud of her because they say,
The honorary
Ramone, Riff Ramone. This scene is probably as close as it comes to just lust after her musical idols.
When she goes into the shower and Dee Dee's playing guitar in the shower.
Yeah.
Oh, he must have loved doing that scene.
Despite the fact that she's, you know, she's kind of undressing and getting in the shower whilst they're sort of singing to her, it's kind of strangely chaste. It's not creepy or weird or overly sexy. There's a sweet sort of innocence to it.
And for me, I think the other really fantastic scene of the film is the one very close to the end where the Ramones are in the school and the students are running amok while all the authority are trying to smoke them out of the school. You have that scene where they're on the float and they're playing Do You Want to Dance, the old Bobby Freeman tune. Do you want to dance? Mr. McGree, played just so wonderfully by Paul Bartel, is, you know, dancing along with them, and he's one of the kids. He's one of the students. And I read where Alan Arkush said that this scene was a tribute to Vincent Minnelli and to Busby Berkeley. I mean, look, my whole experience of Berkeley is just watching the one film, Gold Diggers of 1933, and the image in my head is more of like tightly choreographed numbers with overhead shots of women in geometric shapes. But I guess it's more about the spirit here. And I just love you. It doesn't matter whether you're a jock, whether you're a cheerleader, whether you're a nerd. Everyone celebrates the Ramones. And that's Riff's triumph. She doesn't pick anyone. They're all just, you like the Ramones? Right, you're in my gang. That's fine. And they're all celebrating the music. That's what ties them together. I adore that scene. It's probably as favorite a scene in cinema of anything that I've ever watched. I just adore it.
The ending is almost the same way that Blazing Saddles ends. No, I'm just saying that they've got, like you just said, people from all walks and they're all together and it's just absolute chaos, right? And it's just, you know, he's there, she's there, like they're all there and they're just in the midst of it, you know? And I just think it's funny. Like, it just reminds me of the ending of Blazing Saddles. But I mean, there are so many scenes in this film, though, too, that I think is hilarious. You know, like, for example, with the beginning when Togar is telling the staff to honor and salute the last principal.
As you all know, I am here to replace Professor Webb, who is unable to continue his duties as the chief administrator of this school. And now I would like us all to rise and salute Professor Webb for his wonderful, gallant effort.
And you see them spoon-feeding this guy, Pablum. And then finally, you know, it's like his face drops into the bowl. I love that.
He's there with a straight jacket on in a wheelchair, isn't he?
Right, yeah. And the other one, too, that I love, they go into the guys that are smoking in the boys' room. Let me tell you about it. Going into the guy's John, and it's there. The Clint Howard has his office set up in there, and you see everybody standing in line. You know, it's
Dr. Equal Bauer,
right?
Particularly like the concert where people are, you know, getting their tickets clipped and coming in, and that giant mouse walks in.
Oh, I'm sorry. We don't let any more mice in here. They've been exploding all over the place. Oh, you got headphones? Great.
And, earlier in the film, Miss Togar shows the evils of rock and roll and the Ramones by playing some Ramones to a mouse that explodes. And then at the concert later on, this giant mouse walks in and the guy on the door says, oh, you can't come in, man, because the Ramones make mice explode. And he's like, oh, no, I've got my headphones. He's got these big headphones on.
Right.
He's like, oh, you're cool. And then he walks in. And then throughout the concert, you just see this giant mouse dancing amongst everybody else. I just thought that was genius. That was fantastic.
What I like about a lot of the humor in this film is it probably pays some sort of respect to the creative crew behind the Kentucky Fried Movie, because it's not just not just going for obvious laughs. They're doing these subversive things like the mouse, you know, wearing the headphones so it doesn't explode, or where first the Vincent Van Patten character walks into the toilet, which is already very surreal in itself, but when he walks in it's like he's walked into the Doctor Who TARDIS. It's this big comfy office rather than a toilet cubicle. And all these little things are the sorts of humorous touches that really would have fitted in very nicely into the Kentucky Fried Movie.
But it goes back to, like I was saying, like Mad Magazine, like that's just exactly the way they would present things. But I was going to say that there's a lot of people in the film that are not credited that were actually connected to the Ramones. Like their manager, said Monty Melman, I think it was, he's the guy who plays their manager when Riff meets him.
How many times do I have to tell you? No pizza for you, Joey. More wheat German, riboflavin. Yeah, come on, Joey, eat good.
Herbie,
you
know, Braha?
Yeah. And then there's another guy that actually, I think he's one of the security dudes, Artie Vega. And Arturo Vega was...
Oh, wait, I didn't realize that was him.
Yeah, he's in that too. And I mean, he was the guy who actually created the legendary, you know, logo for the Ramones. You know, and he's considered kind of like the fifth Ramone, you know, in many ways. He's a big one in the family. And then also in the crowd, there is Rodney Bingenheimer's in the crowd. And
he's
Darby Crash.
Darby Crash. Yeah.
He's in it. There's a whole mess of people in this. Joe Donne's in it,
shit.
Uncredited.
Most of the Germs are in it. Lorna Doom's in there.
Dinah Cancer
is in there.
Yeah, from 45 Grave. There's a whole mess of that are really, you know, you don't even realize.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I think the genius of the film, and I don't know whether this was just catching lightning in a bottle, but we were talking about all the little sort of humorous elements that are just thrown in there, and there's so much of it, from the kind of surreal to the kind of sight gags to everything, and it's almost like they're throwing them at you constantly. But what's amazing about the film is that they pretty much all land. There's no real clunkers in there. Do you know what I mean? For them to kind of get all that right.
There's nothing that seems awkward in the film. There's nothing seems like it just stands out and kind of like...
Absolutely, yeah. I think in a weird way, it just feels like you're dropped into this completely sort of realized world where this is how it is, you know?
That's a really rare combination, because you've already gone and said, Bernie, that it was a sweet film, and it certainly is. It's just not mean-spirited. I think, you know,
it's not mean-spirited at all, and
I think I might, you know, use a descriptive term of it's sweet as well, and yet to still have all those gags go really land, because often you might sort of think, well, we're going to have a really hard, dark comedy here, and that means that some people are not going to come out alive. to get these jokes to land their target.
Right.
And yet it shows that you can do both. I mean, this might have sort of been swept away as just another cheapy Roger Corman film, and let's not read too much into it. But for sure, this is a film that I think should be celebrated by every generation who comes after it. I don't think I'm sort of going too over the top to say that. It celebrates the music, it celebrates rock and roll, and it's funny and it is subversive.
You're talking about favorite scenes. I was going to say, one thing that I loved was really great was, even before, the age of CG, is when you get the one, when Togar tells her two toadies to go and get a hold of...
Mr.
McGree, and go and get a hold of the other teacher, the music teacher, and the other one. And the guy can't even get off his ass to send him a note, and folds it up in a paper airplane and fires it out the window. And I thought, that was almost like the beginning of The Simpsons. You kind of see it go out the window, and then it goes on its path, and then it's going along this, going through one door, and then somebody opens the door, and you see it going, and then the next thing you know, it just right into his ear. I just thought that was awesome.
I thought that was great. That was one of my favorite scenes. I think pretty much every scene with Mr. McGree, Paul Bartel, was fantastic.
He was
a real joy throughout the whole thing.
I was going to say about the Ramones themselves, the roles that they're playing in the film, obviously, these guys are not actors, but it just seems like they're so indifferent about just being there. It's just sort of like, we're here. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all just taking it in their stride, aren't they? This is day to day with the Ramones. Yeah.
And it's just like, it seems like they could just give a shit. This is what it's always been. That's who the Ramones are. I mean, whenever you see them live, they just come out on stage and it wouldn't be like, we're going to rock your asses off. It's like, hey, we're the Ramones. Boom. That's it. There's no fanfare. There's no like, are you ready? It's like, no. They just come out.
Again, that's the kind of the lightning being caught in the bottle with this film, because I think if it was anyone other than the Ramones, it wouldn't have worked as well as it does. But having said that, if it was just the Ramones with a different kind of framework about it, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as good. So it's just all these factors coming together and it just kind of almost being the perfect storm, I guess.
It's a different sort of film to say, like, I guess the most obvious example is The Beatles in A Hard Day's Night.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
No, actually, we're just good friends.
Has success changed your life?
Yes.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
Where they really are the focus, and they were a fantastic comedic team. And it was a story about the early days of rock and roll, but it was really more a story about the Beatles. Well, it was scripted, but in their element, and it was very, very comedic. Whereas this, as I said before, is more about PJ Soul's character, Riff Randall, and her love of the Ramones. So there's enough Ramones for you to sort of get to see, well, here they are on stage, but here they are goofing off with wheat German pizza a little bit behind the background without...
They're almost like the kind of Hitchcock MacGuffin, and they kind of drive the story forward, but they don't actually have a huge amount to do in the film.
Right.
Right.
Next, I investigated reports of loss of hearing by individuals due to the high decibel level involved in playing rock and roll music.
I want to come back to Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenoff for just a moment or two. Now, I'm presuming that both of you guys are fans of the film Eating Roll.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know, I've never seen it. I've always meant to, and I've never got around to it.
You have to
You'll love it, Bernie.
That hippie guy's not going to show up. We've thrown away $70 on this light show.
Who's the 9 o'clock?
Some sickie with a Great Dane.
A Great Dane?
$500.
Do we have to kill the dog, too?
Probably.
Yeah, sure I will. It's probably on YouTube or something at this point, so I really don't have any excuses.
Look,
I need
to
check that out.
Even if it's not, just go order yourself a Criterion edition of it. It's so...
Yeah, don't worry.
I was just sort of thinking about this yesterday, was the contrast between the Mary Warrenoff and Paul Bartel characters in Eating Raoul to Rock and Roll High School. So in Rock and Roll High School, Paul Bartel is the straight guy who eventually loosens up and he gets along well with the kids at the end, and he's no longer the straight-laced character that he was at the start of the film. But but Mary Warrenov is the hard-ass disciplinarian all the way through the film. And I don't think it's giving anything away to say about Eating Raoul. It's the opposite. Mary Warrenov in Eating Raoul starts out as straight-laced Mary Bland, but loosens up for reasons that I won't give away to you yet, Bernie. But Paul Bartel is a character who's straight-laced all the way through the film. But really, in both cases, they're still playing characters that are very, very true to what they do in both films. Very, very true to their popular image. And I'm sad to say I sort of haven't seen much else. I'm sure I've seen something else with Paul Bartel in it, but I can't recall what.
There was a film from the 70s, Private Parts. I forget what else. Like, there was a number of things I've seen Bartel was actually in, you know, a whole mess of Corman films. I mean, you know, Death Race, and he's in a number of other films as well.
I always used to get Mary Warrenov mixed up with Lynn Lowry for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
They don't really look alike or anything, but I guess they were in stuff during the same sort of 70s kind of period. Mary Warrenov's in Death Race 2000.
Yeah.
I saw someone put a post on Facebook once saying that they confused Mary Warrenov with Tim Curry.
Well, how about that?
It's wow. The lips.
Weirdly, I can kind of see that as well. Yeah. Right. Oh, she's in tons of great stuff. Yeah.
Any other favorite scenes? Any other points that you wanted to make about the film?
This is something, it's a no-brainer. There's not a lot to contemplate with this film. And it's not, I'm not saying it's a stupid film, because it's not. But it's very, very free-spirited. It's lighthearted, like drive-in fair. I mean, you can have a total blast with this film. I mean, you don't have to be at a drive-in. You can just sit down in the basement with your friends with a good 5.1 surround sound speaker system and just, do you want to dance? There you go, man.
And now one of your hosts for the night from the Ramones, here's Joey.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Countdown. On tonight's show, Paul McCartney, Olivia Newton-John, and that famous English act, Def Leppard. But right now, the Countdown, National Chartbuster.
It was just a couple of days ago that was Joey's birthday. Oh, I think now, man, he would have been in his 60s. The last thing I want to say before we close, I had a really cool Ramones story. I've seen the Ramones probably about, I don't know, 8 or 9 times easily. And every time was better than the last. But there was one time where they were playing a club in Toronto and it was sold out. And me and the girl that I was seeing at the time, we had tickets and we were standing in line. And all these young kids were trying to get into the show and they couldn't get in, you know, just like Rock and Roll High School, you know. And what happened was, you know, we go into the show and, you know, I bought a T-shirt. We're standing there in the crowd. And all of a sudden I see these kids and I, you know, and there's like 4 of them. And I said, how the hell did you guys get in? You get scalper tickets? And they said, no, man, you're not going to believe it. I said, what? And they said, this big Mercedes pulled out of front. And the guy rolled down the window and said, well, where do you load in? And they said, around the side. So he says, you have to show me where to park. So they showed the guy where to park. He said, and all of a sudden he gets out. Joey gets out on the driver's side. They beat on the door, open up the door to let him in. Joey goes in to basically do the show. And right as he's about to close the door, he turns around and says, well, is you kids going to stand out there or are you just coming in? So he automatically just let these 4 kids just go in the back door.
Amazing.
And that's cool. I mean, to me, that's who they were, you know, like that's. So, I mean, it makes me smile whenever I'm thinking about this film because of the whole thing about Riff Randall meeting her idols and that, you know, the kind of fiction parallel with reality, you know?
Why?
That's a lovely story. Awesome. If you're listening to this and you're one of the very few people who's never gotten around to seeing this, we're getting 5 leather jackets up each. That's our rating system for this show from 1 to 5.
Leather jackets out of 5.
5 leather jackets.
And 1 drippy slice of pizza.
Yeah. I just want to say that I think this film is pretty much critic proof. You can't really pick it apart. It's just wonderful. No. Everything in it works. As I keep coming back to the image, but Lightning in a Bottle, it doesn't get any better than this. And if you don't like this, I don't want to be your friend, basically.
2 things I almost forgot that we completely almost overlooked. I'm sorry if I go back. I wanted to say it earlier, but do you know who the director of photography was on this, right?
Oh, God, it was Dean Cundey, wasn't it?
Dean Cundey, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, you know, like for everything that he did, I mean, well, he actually started out with Corman and doing a lot of the lower-end exploitation stuff.
Would this have been, he would have probably done this just after Halloween, wouldn't he?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the other one I wanted to mention, too, was the amazing poster art by one Mr. William Stout.
Yes, yeah.
William Stout was, like, one of the best illustrators out there, you know, and he still is. I mean, for all the work that he's done in so many genre movies, it's not even funny. But it's just, I love that poster. Rock and Roll High School poster is just so definitive, you know.
He sums up the film, doesn't it?
Bernie, did you, was it you that put the post on the Facebook group for the show of that poster on a T-shirt?
No, it was actually. Yes, it was me. Yes, yeah.
I think I'm gonna go out and order one. I think I need that in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Need it in my
wardrobe.
I think
I do as well.
Fantastic.
And you can be an official Mexican too.
Yeah.
So the only thing that I regret about this episode is that I couldn't convince you guys to join me in a three-part harmony version of Rock and Roll High School, the theme song. This is not the first time I've spoken about the film. A few years ago, Dr. Zom joined me on Love That Album to talk about the film. And I've got to say, I didn't go back to listen to it. I have no idea. I cannot recall what I said about the film back then. But even Dr. Zom joined me in a rousing chorus of Rock and Roll High School. I wish I could convince you.
See, you say, Morris, you say even Dr. Zom, but as we all know, Dr. Zom has actually got a hell of a voice and can sing really well. The fact that me and Tim, who probably have similar effects on mice as the Ramones do, are declining to join you in this. So I think we're actually doing everyone a favor.
It's a shame. I don't want to speak for Bernie, but as far as I go, I can't even carry a note in a bucket.
Oh, hell, me. I'm the same. Jesus. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
If you pardon my blasphemy there. Yeah.
Well, I don't care about history. Rock, rock. No, I'm not going to go any further. The halos will kick me out.
And what would you have done with the school anyway?
Rock the roof off it. Hit it, Marky!
We're going to talk about episode 42 of See Here. That will be recorded in June of 2017. And at the beginning of the year, we put out a call to our small but loyal community for requests for films that they wanted us to discuss. And Barry Noble, who I feel very privileged to have made the friendship of, we've met in real life, as have you, Tim, when you came to visit us. He made the request that we cover a film written and directed by Mr. Eric Idle out of the Monty Python team. This is All You Need Is Cash, The Rattles. The parody, if you will, on the history of some other group that came out of Liverpool. Can't remember them. A little too obscure for my liking, for my taste. The Rattles, All You Need Is Cash. I think originally made for TV, but I might have seen it in the cinema here at the long gone, long departed Valhalla Cinema. But that's going to be our discussion next month, as requested by Barry. We have four requests for this year. So if you didn't get a request in, but really think that there's a film you'd like us to talk about, then just keep those suggestions and we'll be good for 2018. Barry, we'll be talking about your film next month. Looking very forward to that. I have gone and asked someone, I don't want to mention the names just in case in the last minute he can't do it, but I have gone and asked a Beatles specialist to come and join, and I know this is a favourite film of his, so we'll see. We do come up with another person to join our trio for next month. If we could, then we would be the Fab Four, or as they call them in the Rattles film, the Pre-Fab Four. So we'll be looking forward to talking about that next month. So any housekeeping here, if you want to listen to the program, well, you're obviously doing so you know the podcast catcher of your choice, or you can get us on iTunes, or you can listen to us from seehere.podbean.com. Please, we'd be so grateful if you went and let your friends know that we exist. In the last few weeks, I'd gone and submitted the show to be included as part of the TuneIn app. So if you happen to have the TuneIn app on your phone or other device of choice, then you can stream or download us from that. If you want to email us, then you can do so at seeherhere podcast@gmail.com. If you want to join in the fun and talk about music-related films, then you can go to the Facebook group, which is facebook.com/groups/seeherepodcast. And we've got some good things lined up. I'm trying to get maybe a couple of bonus episodes in. I've sent some requests to the directors of a couple of films. We'll see. We'll see what happens. I live in hope. It'd be nice to have that as maybe some bonus episodes for your ear holes. Some very exciting stuff coming up, I hope. There you go. End of episode 41. It's been a blast, gents, talking about the Rock and Roll High School with y'all. So class is finished for the day. And until next time, I don't care about history because I just want to get some kicks, and Bernie and Tim just want to get some chicks. Rock, rock, rock,
rock, rock, rock, rock, rock, rock, rock, rock,
rock. I nearly got you in. Nearly got you into sing.
Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
Bye.
See you next month.
Somehow.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.